From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Those of you who read H.P. Lovecraft's science fiction or his horror stories know it's a bit of a problem to be a fan of the man. He was a terrible racist. He was a sexist, too, and homophobic, and a snob. But a lot of people agree he was also brilliant and wholly original. The fact is, his fears and prejudices about immigrants and a permissive society fueled his plots. So did, by the way, his fear of going insane. Today in the program, we're talking about H.P. Lovecraft, about his life, which he lived in obscurity, and about his work, which included a fascinating concept of the universe. The historian Leslie Klinger will join us today to take us through all of this, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. How many of you know the work of H.P. Lovecraft? It's more than a cult following, but there is a niche here. Science fiction fans, horror, maybe fantasy. He didn't really have a following when he was alive. Lovecraft died poor and mostly unrecognized in 1937. His acclaim came many years later. And there's another asterisk to his work that we should mention right up front. Lovecraft was a racist. He was anti-Semitic. He didn't think much of women or poor people or immigrants or gay people. The uncomfortable fact is that his fears about outsiders was one of the engines of his work and his imagination. The fantasy writer Alan Moore said that you could see Lovecraft as an almost unbearably sensitive barometer of American dread. In fact, he conceived of a very different order to the universe. It was an anti-mythology where there was no deity to look after things and where powerful and terrifying creatures lived among the humans. Today in the program, we're talking about H.P. Lovecraft, his life, and his work. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Leslie Klinger is going to be our guest throughout the hour. He's going to help take us through the life and work of H.P. Lovecraft. He's a literary historian, an expert on Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. We've had him on the program talking about those subjects, as a matter of fact. He's written some 20 books on Holmes, including the three-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. He's joining us today from the studios at UCLA in Los Angeles. His new book is called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft, and he's joining us. And Leslie Klinger, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. That was a terrific introduction for Lovecraft. I think you really sort of summed up the key points about his career, but we'll expand.
Yes, that's the point, yes. Well, let's start with your own relationship, if I can put it that way, with H.P. Lovecraft. You discovered his work, if I understand this right, relatively later in your life.
Well, discovered is relatively speaking. I started reading very young, and my reading habits didn't go much farther than science fiction. I read tons and tons and tons of science fiction. I was mainly interested in the modern masters, being those old guys, Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and so on. And so I heard of Lovecraft. I knew he existed out there, but I didn't read it because it was old stuff. Right. I wanted to read new things. So I didn't really focus on Lovecraft until the last three, 4 years when I finally started to pay attention to all of these writers who had said that they were so deeply influenced by Lovecraft and thought it was time to figure out what they were talking about.
So you thought, okay, I need to dig in here a little bit, see if it's to my liking. So what did you think? When you first read, like your first story or even your first page, what did you make of it?
I thought this guy is somebody I should have read a lot sooner.
Right.
The stories have a sort of delicious mixture of antiquarian language, slow build-ups and really scary wrap-ups, twist endings in some cases, deep, deep horror. But it builds so slowly that it kind of sucks you in. And in many ways, it reminded me of Dracula. Dracula is very much the same style. You know something bad is happening, but it takes a long time till you get to the point in the book, Dracula, where you figure out what is bad and why it's so bad. And Lovecraft did that quite deliberately. Huh. That was his aim. He said he wanted to draw pictures that were, he said, 99% realistic. Only if you did that could you sell the horror element.
Isn't he said it should almost be kind of crafted like a hoax.
Yes. Yes, it should be believable. It should be something that draws you in. And for an annotator like me, that's marvelous because it means I get to look at all of the hoax elements in great detail. And I think one of the things that's easy to overlook in reading Lovecraft, and jumping around a little bit here, but is the extent of his research. The amount of work that he puts into these simple stories. He started in his life with a deep interest in science.
Right.
He was a prodigy as a young child, reading very young and writing quite young, writing poetry at the age of seven.
Yeah.
But his great passion as a young teenager, besides Sherlock Holmes, which we'll come back to,
nice.
Was astronomy. And his initial writing was serious science writing. He wrote a regular column on astronomy for the local newspapers. He published a journal on astronomy. And he was fascinated by astronomy and the other burgeoning new sciences of the day, physics and the developments in chemistry. And he paid a lot of attention to that. And that detail, that intense interest shows in his early stories. You read a story like Beyond the Wall of Sleep, and there is there's genuine astronomy in that story, drawn from the headlines.
Do we have? We'll talk about this in more detail as we go. But do you have a sense of when you read his work now, his creation, for example, of this, you know, kind of reordering the universe? In some of his work, does that show a kind of disillusionment with not just a religious worldview, but a conventional worldview that his exploration of science may have given him in some way?
I think so. I think that the more he learned about science, the more he learned that we couldn't know or that was beyond our grasp, certainly beyond our grasp at that time.
Right.
As he read about relativity and learned about a deep space exploration, it became more and more apparent to him that there were things far, far beyond the ken of the average human whose sense of existence extended no further than their hometown.
Yeah. I want to get this part out of the way, although we'll come back to it. But as I mentioned, there's the distasteful part of his personality, the hateful part. I mean, he was racist and anti-Semitic, and I wanted to get your sense about how people like yourself, who are interested in his worldview and his writing and these fantasies that he created, is it worth overlooking the other part?
Well, I think it is. First, I wanted to say he wasn't, how shall I put this, an active anti-Semite, racist bigot. I mean, he didn't found an organization to drive out immigrants. He didn't picket. He didn't fulminate publicly about this stuff. But it was clear in his correspondence,
yeah,
which we're going to have to talk about,
He
had strongly held views about those subjects, and he shared them with his friends,
right,
with his friends only. By the way, if friends including several Jewish people who he thought were okay Jews because they had assimilated.
Like his wife.
Basically, right, like his wife, yeah, who had basically given up her Jewishness. the problem is that if we eliminate that characteristic, and it's hard to quite see where it came from. I'm not sure whether he was actually taught those principles by his caregivers. His father died when he was very young, very, very young. His father died when he was 3.
Right.
In an insane asylum.
Yeah.
His mother died in 1922, I believe. In 1920, she was admitted to an insane asylum. And so Lovecraft had this deep-rooted fear that he himself was sick, right. Going to go insane. He was raised by his aunts. They don't seem to be particularly bad people. I don't think it was a matter of he was surrounded by bigots who brought him up in a bigoted way. But he was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island, which was at that time very much a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant community undergoing massive changes. Yeah. There were great influxes of Filipinos and Italians into the community. And I think in part it was resentment. He explicitly says about his stay in New York City. He lived in New York for 2 years of his life, the only 2 years he didn't live in Providence. And he resented that the mongrel populations around him were succeeding while he was failing. Mm-hmm. And it was clearly an irrational judgment, but nonetheless, it was driven by his own failure.
You know, I get a sense that he's probably not unlike a lot of people of that time, not excusing his racism, but, you know, he was a Yankee exceptionalist. And I'm guessing a lot of people in New England and in many other parts of the United States and the world probably thought the same kinds of things about outsiders.
I think that's right. I think that he really was, as you read in your quotation from Alan Moore's wonderful introduction, you know, a barometer of the times. This was a time when, we didn't succumb to Nazi propaganda here overtly, but nonetheless, the eugenics movement was in full blossom, a movement that Lovecraft supported. Nationalist, almost racial pride, the idea of Aryans, the idea of pure races was gaining great popularity. And Lovecraft was part of that community. He supported eugenics. He supported the ideas, the root ideas behind Nazism, mm-hmm. that Germany should be a country for Aryans and the other people should be excluded. He never advocated extermination of the other populations, but he wanted to see purification. He wanted to see that kind of purity enhanced and supported. Would he have moved all the immigrants out of Providence if he could? I have no doubt of that.
Yeah.
But to say that he was of that character simply means that he's probably not somebody I would have enjoyed meeting.
Right.
But, you know, we're not asked to do that.
Yeah.
He's written material. We don't have to go into his life necessarily. Very, very little of his writing has any racial overtones at all. But they're all pervaded with this sense of outsideness, the otherness.
One thing Neil Gaiman said about this question was that, of course, it's not a good thing the way he thought about other races and gay people, for example. But without it, you may not have the fiction. So, in some weird way, it did influence, his worldview and the way he crafted his stories. Is it fair to put it that way?
I think that's right. I think he extrapolated from his own feelings to see that essentially the entire human race was outsiders, was composed of outsiders. That we were insignificant. That we were part of a much, much larger cosmos than our imaginations could readily adapt to. I think that sense of outsideness also explains why so many, unlike me, discover Lovecraft when they're 12, 13, 14 years old, when certainly every human specimen undoubtedly feels that they're the only one like them in the entire universe, and they're cut off from all those other people. Teenagers were just filled with that biological imperative that we're special, and why doesn't anybody understand us?
Sort of a creepier version of the Holden Caulfield kind of.
Yes. Ooh, I like that image. Holden Caulfield meets Clulu.
Yeah. I want to get to all of that part. Let's talk about his life. Born in 1890, as you say, Providence, Rhode Island. Didn't stray far for long. Went to New York for a couple of years. He fancied himself a gentleman, kind of a man of another era in some way?
Oh, absolutely. Another century. He took the pose of being an 18th century gentleman. I don't mean in the sense of, you know, lording it over other people, but in the sense that there's a small element here of this being an excuse, because I pointed out I read some quotations the other day from Lovecraft in which he talked about how his art was its own reward. Essentially, he didn't care that he was only writing for 7 or 8 readers. In fact, if no one read his work, that was okay. Well, that sounds like many people I know who haven't succeeded
who
as
selling.
Writers. Exactly. Yeah. Who aren't selling their material. It's like, well, I'm doing this for art. That was probably a tiny part of it. It was a pose, but it was a pose that he was very comfortable with.
Yeah.
He revered his own ancestors. He was fascinated by the mores and the culture of the 18th century, especially in New England. He studied it a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it translated into his work by him choosing to use many, many antiquarian words in his writing. He cultivated the writing style of an 18th century gentleman as well. And it works for the subject matter, I think, because it's so different from suddenly finding a monster or something supernatural. It's sort of like first of all, there's the incongruity of this sort of gentlemanly aristocratic age combined with space travel, elder gods, creatures, and so on. That's part of why he did it, I think, was to create that contrast. And second, the language itself makes you work for it and kind of lulls you into a more soporific mood as you read it. It's like reading something old and boring.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting about that incongruity that you mentioned. It's kind of like you find some really ancient document about a spaceship, you know, like
right.
This dusty, old, yellowed, withered paper, but is saying something about this piece of science fiction, and that made it all the more compelling. And that seems to be why, as you say, on one hand, it really works.
Right. I think another element to it is it also suggests that these are not new problems. These are not new discoveries.
Yeah.
Even though most of the stories are set in modern times, the only exception to that being Charles Dexter Ward, which has segments that are in the historical past. But by couching the modern story in this kind of almost antiquarian feeling language, I think it hints that the underlying horrific elements are a lot older than we think.
Mm.
They're not a new problem. They've been around for generations.
There's a section I want to have you read from. This is called The Unnameable, suggested as a good example of. You know, I'll just have you read just a bit here, so we don't need to put it entirely in context, but it does give you a sense, those the uninitiated who don't really know his work, of what you're talking about by that antiquarian style.
Yes, and to put it in context, the story is, it's not much of a story. It's really almost a speech, one long speech on the subject of how difficult it is to write horror.
Yeah.
That when you're talking about something that is indescribable, how do you describe it? So his narrator here, who is in the middle of that argument, says, though I well realized the futility of imaginative and metaphysical arguments against the complacency of an orthodox sun dweller, something in the scene of this afternoon's colloquy moved me to more than usual contentiousness. The crumbling slate slabs, the patriarchal trees, and the centuried gambrel roofs of the witch-haunted old town that stretched all around all combined to rouse my spirit in defense of my work, and I was soon carrying my thrusts into the enemy's own country. This is a young horror writer sitting in a cemetery with a friend of his discussing the challenges of writing horror fiction.
There's something so gothic about it. You do sense, if you're familiar with Edgar Allan Poe, and he was very influenced, Lovecraft was, by Poe.
Absolutely.
You get that in that, don't you think?
Yes. He had two great influences in his early writing. One was Poe, and the other was Lord Dunsany. Mm-hmm. And Dunsany is also a very florid writer with very colorful language and very different, almost poetic, sort of more different from Poe only in the sense that so much of Poe's writing conveys a sadness, dark, umber tones, whereas Dunsany could be very bright colors, but both highly fanciful, and Lovecraft knew very well that he was imitating their styles.
Here's an email from Daniel, who writes, while Lovecraft wasn't particularly adept at writing dialogue, thankfully he wrote very little of it, he was a master at creating a sense of space and atmosphere, chiefly an almost claustrophobic atmosphere of unease. Do you think he's got something there, Daniel?
Absolutely. Poe's own work in that area, sort of building up the moods, is something that Lovecraft very much wanted to learn from. And so we see that meticulous building of the mood, the landscape. One of my favorite stories of all is At the Mountains of Madness, which is set in the context of an Antarctic expedition. And it does
what does
a wonderful
that sound like,
job.
By the way. Does that sound not sound like Frankenstein?
Well, Frankenstein and also the narrative of Pym, Poe's great story about the Antarctic as well. But yes, very much so. And that story builds very slowly with a deep scientific background, discussion of the sort of the bureaucracy of getting the expedition going. Then we really feel the sort of chill of being in the Antarctic. And slowly, slowly, we get to the horrific elements of the story. But it builds this terrible mood of it's one of those to read sitting in front of a warm fire. And that's true of so many of his stories. You read a story like The Festival, set in the mythical town of Kingsport. You just feel this late October night in this small town by the sea, with creepy shadows and almost you can feel it. I don't think there is any fog in the story, but you feel like there must be fog rolling in and so on.
We have Leslie Klinger with us, literary historian and expert on, all kinds of things, Sherlock Holmes among them, and H.P. Lovecraft. His latest book is called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about H.P. Lovecraft. If you're a science fiction or horror fan, you may know who he is, although not many did when he was alive. These days, he is revered for his stories, which include a strange concept of the universe where ancient and grotesque creatures shared the planet with humans. Leslie Klinger is our guest today, literary historian, expert on Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. He's got a new annotated collection of H.P. Lovecraft's work. It's called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft, and he's joining us from Los Angeles. Leslie Klinger, one of the things that, I mean, he had this concern, as a lot of people did at the time, of outsiders. But another engine in his work, in his stories, was this, and you already referred to the fact, his mother and father both died in insane asylums. So that was another engine, it seems like, his real fear of what, of going insane?
Yes, I think so. I think that he had some sort of breakdown in his late teens. He was, at that time, we don't know a lot of the details of it. He was probably, his mother had not yet entered the hospital. He became quite ill, leading to him dropping out of school. It's psychiatrists can have such a field day with Lovecraft. Sort of, as soon as his mother died, he made this remarkable recovery and suddenly sort of launched himself out into the world with great renewed vigor. But I don't want to give the impression that Lovecraft is this sort of hermit-like recluse who sat in his attic, madman, composing this fiction. He was a very sociable fellow, and that sociability expressed itself primarily through correspondence. Early in his career, he became involved with something called the United Amateur Press Association. Today, the internet would have made that all that unnecessary, because this was a society of amateur writers, bloggers, we might say, who wrote fiction and poetry and political commentary and philosophical essays and published them in their own amateur journals. Lovecraft became an enthusiastic member of that organization, eventually becoming its president. And somewhere along the way began corresponding with dozens, hundreds of people. It's estimated that Lovecraft wrote as many as 100,000 letters during his life, ranging in length from postcards cramped with tiny handwriting to letters, handwritten letters as long as 70 pages. These letters would go into his philosophy, his thinking about writing, his life experiences, and so on. And they're an incredible body of material. But they reveal, as I said, this sort of lively sociability. He enjoyed talking to other people, even if it was by correspondence.
But was he manic? I mean, you know, a 70-page letter, that has to reveal something. Maybe he just had a lot to say, but that that gave me a sense of this kind of burst of energy he must have gotten with writing.
Sure. I think he was, and you know, he visited friends. He didn't do all that writing in the attic either. Traveled, not extensively, but he traveled in the Northeast, and he traveled as far as Florida. He would have friends come visit him, and he would go visit friends. And there are many fond reminiscences that have been published of his company. He was an affable fellow, loved ice cream, loved cats. Apparently had a wide circle of friends.
But you also said he was kind of strange.
Oh, yes.
What do you think that means? What do you mean by that? Just would he have been... I'm wondering what it would have been to sit down and talk to him.
I mean, one of the things I get a sense about him is, although there are some... He's written some very funny things. Yeah. But by and large, he strikes me as somebody who was so serious. I can't remember seeing any photographs of Lovecraft in which he appears to be smiling or having a good time. All of the pictures are very serious pictures, and I think he saw himself as a very serious person. And he also didn't have a lot of material success in his life. And to say a lot, I mean, it's a great example. He had no material success in his life. He was a starving artist in the classic sense. And I don't care what your mental attitude is. If you can't put food on the table and you're eating dirt, you know, it doesn't make one a particularly happy person.
Right.
So I'm not going to fault him for all that.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST, by the way, is the number to join us. We have Krista joining us from Salt Lake. Krista, hi.
Hey, Doug. How's it going?
Great.
Yeah, I lived in Providence for 5 years before I came to Utah, and Lovecraft was something of a folk hero. And one of the big things to do was to go out to the Swan Point Cemetery, especially on Halloween, and find his grave. And the first time
I was there last week.
I was kind of disappointed with his grave. I was expecting something larger than life like he was, and it's this little tiny headstone. And if I'm remembering correctly, though, it's kind of funny that at the bottom it said something like, I am Providence, or I was Providence. So even on that little
headstone. I am Providence, yes.
Yeah, that ego came through.
Well, the headstone was erected many years after his death. There is a family monument on which his name appears, and the headstone is there as well. But this is a relatively new thing. I don't remember when the headstone appeared, but it wasn't right away. But no, the grave is not. There's no gargoyles. You know, there's no monsters. It's a very plain headstone. Yes, I was there last week, and there was snow around it. We were able to get there walking through the sort of frozen snow. But there was a flower there. Someone had left a flower.
So do they Edgar Allan Poe-like pilgrimages to his grave?
Oh, yes.
Gravesite? Yeah.
Yes. Chris is certainly not alone in being someone who visited the grave. It's a popular site.
Krista, thanks.
Absolutely, thanks.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. From Twitter, we are hearing from Jeremy, who says, I wonder if there's an impact in Lovecraft's writing that we, in a post-supernatural horror world, are immune to. He writes, maybe it's the fact Lovecraft's work is a germ that sparked a popularity of complex and shocking supernatural media. What do you think?
Well, Jeremy, how is it that you conclude that we're in a post-supernatural world? Wow. I think, if anything, Lovecraft would be more and more fascinated by our modern age. There are so many more possibilities of the kind of things that freaked him out. As we now learn about chaos theory and we see more and more the size of the universe, both outward and inward, watching Cosmos the other day, the PBS series, you know, I kept saying to myself, wow, Lovecraft would have such a fascination with not just traveling out to the distant reaches of the universe that science has now shown to be there, but traveling in to the atom and down deep into the atom. All of those possibilities of things that are so far beyond human perception. I think the supernatural is more present with us than ever. Science is still not even remotely close to explaining the things that for thousands of years we have treated as supernatural. Nobody is still, I'm sorry, I'm not a believer in the occult. I have had no personal supernatural experiences, but I still defy anyone to come up with definitive scientific explanations for all of the phenomena that have been experienced.
I was wondering
that we label as supernatural.
Yeah.
So.
I wonder what he would have made of something like artificial intelligence. I mean, he wrote about the idea of monsters, for example. I wonder how he would have personified a monster in the digital era. Because he thought about monsters and what that meant and for human identity as well, it seems.
Sure. The idea that personalities could arise out of an array of computers. Certainly a well-explored theme in science fiction, I suspect would have fascinated Lovecraft. Look at his ideas that he explored at great length in several stories about mind transplantation, telepathic communication from beings beyond the stars. Certainly, science hasn't explained those things away or suggested that they couldn't possibly occur. If anything, when you start to think about wormholes and black holes and all that, it becomes we've sort of got new names for things that still don't make a lot of sense. We're no closer to understanding what the limits are. I think Lovecraft would thrive in modern science, in writing, in finding the horror elements. And of course, there are many writers who have taken up Lovecraft's mantle.
Right.
Many, many fine writers who have taken that sensibility and applied it to contemporary times.
One of the things that
too many
you,
to mention.
Yeah. One of the things that one of the stories you weren't able to include, although you wanted to, Norton only gave you what 800 pages or so.
Right. It's if the readers had an unlimited budget,
yeah,
then we could have had everything in there. If people were willing to spend $60 on a book instead of $40.
Yeah, $39.95 is the price point. So you had to go with that, which I get. But one of the stories you're disappointed you couldn't include is one that Neil Gaiman has talked about, and others. It's called The Outsider.
The Outsider, yes.
And the reason
I excluded it, by the way, is not because of quality at all. It's because it's not strictly a mythos story.
Yeah. What's interesting about the story seems like, and this seems like a theme maybe in some of his work, is this realization. The narrator that, I don't know, I feel weird about giving some of this stuff away, I guess, Leslie Klinger, but I'll just say it. I mean, the realization that he has, the narrator, that he, in fact, is the monster.
Yes. And I think that's an important theme in a number of Lovecraft stories.
Yeah.
Certainly Shadow over Innsmouth, again, sorry about spoilers, is very much that. And I think that, again, reflects the psychology of Lovecraft, that there are things inside him that he's afraid of. And so he himself was the outsider. There's no doubt in my mind. And as Neil Gaiman has said, and who at 13 isn't? So Lovecraft managed to get it out there on paper. And I think that story has great appeal and really, in many ways, sums up Lovecraft's own feelings about himself. But it had to go.
Yeah.
It had to go along with some other wonderful stories.
Yeah.
The Music of Eric Zahn, Rats in the Wall, The Shunned House. These are terrific stories. But I tried to come up with a kind of a unifying theme, that being Arkham and the development of this sort of Elder Gods mythos cycle.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to include in the collection some of the stories. People asked me, why did I include stories like Dagon, Beyond the Wall of Sleep? Those are very, very early stories. They were written when he was in his early 20s and published shortly after that. I think they're important stories to see the development of the ideas. Dagon is essentially a primitive version of Call of Cthulhu, and Beyond the Wall of Sleep is a more primitive version of The Shadow Out of Time.
Hmm.
But to see how he started to develop those ideas, I think is very useful.
I want to get to the mythos because it's an important part of his work. When we get back from a break, Leslie Klinger is with us. His new book, The Annotated H.P. Lovecraft. He's joining us from Los Angeles. You can join us too, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about H.P. Lovecraft. We have Leslie Klinger with us. His new annotated collection of Lovecraft is called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft, and he's joining us from Los Angeles. So I want to ask you about this mythos, this sort of anti-mythology that H.P. Lovecraft comes up with. Talk a little bit about this. These are not creatures that he's conceiving of, that he's conceived from this conventional sort of Christian worldview where you have heaven and hell and good and bad in that context. His vision is quite different. It involves these ancient powers and these an indifferent universe and these really amazing creatures.
Yes, yeah, you put your finger on it. I think I summed it up in a sentence in my introduction, saying Lovecraft was not Tolkien. This was not a man who sat down and tried to figure out a structure for a universe in the sense that today we have a people who do world building in their fiction. By the way, there is a very popular role-playing game called The Call of Cthulhu, and named after one of Lovecraft's most famous stories, and it does have strict rules. I think Lovecraft himself would have rejected those. Mm-hmm. He was in many ways anti-mythos. His view of the universe was that, as I've said earlier, it was in great part unknowable and unnameable, that humankind was is an insignificant element in that universe, that the universe is so large that it is sheer egotism to believe that the universe is structured around humans or that we can even understand the rules of the universe. And so he conceived of a universe that was, you said exactly the right word, indifferent to humankind. And it is presumptuous of us to think that we are the superior beings. There are clearly beings to whom we are superior, but equally so, it is highly likely that there are beings superior to us. Mm. And to us, they would appear as gods, older than us, some younger than humans. And so his stories revolve around the discovery by humans of that truth, that there are forces, beings in the universe that were beyond their conception and now they have to understand exist, and that they are merely, that they, as humans, are in many cases just mere flies zooming around this universe being swatted at by these elder gods or beings.
Yeah. It's interesting. Here's another comment from Daniel who sent this email earlier. This is something that I think Alan Moore gets at in the introduction to the book. Daniel writes, could it be argued that Lovecraft's popularity today stems in part from our own increasing cultural unease with the things beyond our borders that we can't understand or explain? I think Alan Moore thinks so. Do you?
Yes, I do. I think that if anything, and as I said, some of that philosophy was beginning in the 20s and the 30s when Lovecraft was at his height. But I think it's, if anything, even more so today. I think the internet, in a way, shows us more of the universe and makes us realize that there's more stuff out there than we ever dreamt of in our philosophy. We can now easily see what's going on in France or China or Thailand or Africa, and it isn't in English. It isn't all in English. Some of it is, but it isn't all in English, and it isn't all comfortable and recognizable. And I think so. I think our own sense of those boundaries is crumbling as we're seeing that we live in a much larger world than we ever really thought before. It was easy before,
yeah.
Back in the 1920s or. Certainly, maybe before the 1920s, to live in a village or a small town and never leave it. And we didn't have to worry about those other people out there. But now there is so much distance, action at a distance, that we have to understand that there is a universe outside our own little comfort zone.
Let's take another call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's see, Kathy is with us in Salt Lake City. Kathy, hi.
Hi. My comment is just that my daughter wrote her college thesis at Scripps College comparing Poe and Lovecraft. And she said the most interesting thing she thought Lovecraft did was the way he created monsters that were obscure on purpose, because that's how fear manifests itself in your mind, which is something she thought Lovecraft did better than Poe.
Huh. What do you think, Leslie Klinger?
The unnameable, yes.
Yeah.
I think he did surpass Poe in certain respects. Although Poe doesn't have, there's not, we don't have zombies or vampires in Poe either.
Yeah.
Poe is very much focused in his stories on sort of vague dread. Fall of the House of Usher, one of the greatest of his stories. It's like, what is going on there? There's just no explanations are offered. But Lovecraft did take it one step further. And Lovecraft has become very popular with the academics. That's a development that occurred sort of starting in the 70s when Lovecraft was finally sort of getting the attention of a lot of academics. And it certainly hasn't let up.
That despite the efforts of Edmund Wilson, who didn't think much of Lovecraft's work. Here's a comment from Matt, who says there was some hubbub and some poo-pooing in the literary world when the Library of America published Lovecraft's tales. He mentions Edmund Wilson, who said Lovecraft was a hack, denigrated his writing. You want to say something about that?
Well, certainly, because there's a wonderful sentence, I wish I had it here to read you, in which Wilson said that Lovecraft was right up there with the infantile writing of those people in the Baker Street Irregulars. Wilson was deeply out of touch with the ideas of popular culture, and he was an interesting critic. And very well known in his time, but he had very little interest in fans. One of the great reasons why Norton was interested in publishing the Annotated Lovecraft was because of that intense community of fans. Just as there is in the Sherlock Holmes world and in the vampire universe as well, there is a very deep body of amateur literature written by fans examining every single aspect of these works. And that intense fan base means that somebody would buy the books and somebody would be interested in the books. And it's been a great delight to me to dive into that community. There's a reason, by the way, that this book is called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft, and that's because there are other annotated editions that have been done by other scholars, none of them recently. And one of the things I tried to do in mine that was different from some of the other annotated collections was to show the breadth of the scholarship surrounding Lovecraft, that there are hundreds and hundreds of articles and books that have been written about Lovecraft's work.
I wanted to ask you about the Death Diary. What does that tell us about? I mean, he had stomach cancer. That's what he died from.
A very painful way to go.
Well, yeah, what a way to go. 46 when he died in 1937. Have you had a chance to look at that much? And what does that tell us about horror?
I've read segments of it. Yeah. But it doesn't have a lot of philosophy in it that I recall. It's more about his experiences and some of his regrets. There's a page that I reproduced in his in my annotated from one of his journals in which he had laid out a chart showing his production of stories and his plans to write for many, many, many more years. And that those were sadly cut off. And the Death Diary is really more a sense of his interesting ability to be objective about himself and developed much later in his life. I don't think he had that ability early on, as few of us do. That he was able to see what he achieved. He wrote about it. He wrote a number of essays about his own writing his disappointment in the things that he didn't get to do. So it's poignant, but I don't think there's any deep philosophical visions in that Death Diary.
He wasn't terribly prolific. I mean, not given the number of letters he wrote. 85 stories?
85 stories. Yeah. 85 stories, three novels, one of them not published anywhere during his lifetime. Only one story published in book form ever during his lifetime. He wrote a lot of material, but he couldn't find a market for a lot of it, and some of it is not very good. I think if you were to pull together, if I had had my druthers and had been able to publish a book that included every story worth reading, it wouldn't be a lot longer. It would be 35 or 40 stories. And it would add in the third novel called The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. He wasn't terribly prolific, partly because he died young.
Yeah, of course. James sends this via email. James, by the way, who describes himself as an author who writes in homage to Lovecraft. He wants to know if you have a favorite monster or a favorite god from the mythos.
Well, who doesn't like the unpronounceable Nyarlathotep, who we know so little about? But only because there's no physical descriptions of Nyarlathotep, and so maybe he doesn't have tentacles. I don't have any particular partiality to one monster or another. I mentioned, by the way, earlier, and I just want to, because it's me, I have to say this, I mentioned earlier that Lovecraft was a Sherlock Holmes
right,
fan.
Of course, yeah. He was,
of course, young at exactly the right time. So born in 1890, which means in 1903, when Sherlock Holmes returned in the Strand magazine with The Adventure of the Empty House, Lovecraft was 13 years old. The perfect
time
to be
yeah.
reading. And of course, he was reading Holmes. We know that, first of all, he formed a Sherlock Holmes club among his friends. He was Holmes, and other people got assigned other roles to play. But there's also clear borrowings from Sherlock Holmes stories in his stories. The most obvious is the story called The Hound, which is in many ways an homage to the brilliant Hound of the Baskervilles that came out in 1901. And there are other stories as well. And there's also a good deal of crossover between Sherlockians and Lovecraftians. There's a corresponding fan base. There's a number of scholars in the Sherlock Holmes universe who have also written fine pieces about Lovecraft.
Hmm. It's Leslie Klinger. He is the creator of this new annotated H.P. Lovecraft, and he joined us from the studios of UCLA in Los Angeles. Leslie, good to talk to you again.
Great to be on the show, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.